This is Teach in Books, a podcast all about the ways people teach, learn, and work with literature. I'm Jessica McDonald, and on today's episode, I am chatting with Rebecca Ludolph, who is a PhD candidate in literary studies at Wilfrid Laurier University. And we're chatting today about more book club experiences, specifically Rebecca's book club experience, reading Hiromi Goto's 2001 novel, The Kappa Child. So I met Rebecca at a conference a couple of years ago, where I heard a bit about her research, which, you know, from that conference talk was on reading for social change. And I heard her talk a little bit about damage-centered reading practices in and around book clubs, especially book clubs made up of white women who sort of quote-unquote read to learn. I'd been thinking a lot about her work in 2020 because I was reading a lot myself, and I was also thinking through the implications of this idea of reading as work or reading as labor or reading to learn, especially in the context of amplifications of Black Lives Matter, the ongoing struggles against racial violence, and also just personally because at the same time I was joining the first book club that I had ever joined in my life, which I know I've told you all about, which is the Alice Munro Book Club. And so I was thinking about the politics of reading in ways that I hadn't before in 2020, the dynamics of reading collaboratively, because I seem to have been doing that a little bit more in 2020, strangely enough, while it was a very isolated time, an isolating year. Plus, this podcast came about, and so I was thinking about teaching and learning contexts sort of far and wide, really loosely figured, and how book clubs fit into complicate or are complicated versions themselves of teaching and learning environments. So Rebecca's work had been on my mind. I asked her if she would be so good as to come on the podcast and chat with me about her book club experiences, given her research expertise. And that's what we do in this episode. So first things first, usually, as you know, I'd just like to give a spoiler alert that if you haven't read this novel, The Kappa Child, and you are interested in reading it, we do talk about the whole novel. And in fact, Rebecca gives an amazing, detailed, but also concise summary of the novel. And it's a really complicated and beautifully complex novel. So I'm so admire her for being able to summarize it so well. Yeah, if you, I lost my train of thought there, but if you have not read the novel and you want to, then this is your cue to stop the episode and, you know, just go read it. If not, or if you've already read it, I hope you have, then stick with me. Here is my chat with Rebecca. How about just to start, if you want to tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
My name is Rebecca Ludolph, and I'm a PhD candidate at Wilfrid Laurier University. I'm working with Dr. Tanis McDonald. I live and work and have for most of my life lived on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, the Haudenosaunee, and the Neutral People, specifically the Haldimand Tract, which is the land that was promised to the Haudenosaunee as their home and is at this moment still being actively contested. In my scholarly work, I'm interested in literary cultures that are invested in the idea that reading fiction has an important role in working for social change, societal betterment, however you want to describe that. And in particular, I'm interested in the reading practices that have been ascribed to a demographic that is primarily made up of white women, which would include myself, though I'm talking about non-professional reading practices much of the time, and I am increasingly a more professionalized reader. So that's a contested boundary for me. But the main belief that I devote a lot of my time to is this idea that literature can provide a window into the experience of someone else who is different than you, someone who's had a different life experience, and that your emotional response to this textual depiction provides the reader with some knowledge of what it means to be that other person, and that this produces a kind of empathy that's necessary for social change. And so I'm looking at some of the assumptions in that while also trying not to throw out the idea that an emotional response to books is actually something that might be ambivalent, but can be powerful and can be transformative. And of course, doing all that working within, because I'm looking at what is often under the umbrella of Canadian literature within a settler colonial context, where books have been a part of nation building, canon building has been a part of nation building. So that's where I sit, quite literally and also academically.
Lovely. I actually didn't realize that maybe through this conversation today, we might be fulfilling a listener request I got, because once you started talking about empathy, and I should have known this based on what I know about your work, but I had a listener request to talk about the relationship between literature and empathy on this podcast. So perhaps this episode will get into that realm, depending on where our conversation goes today. So yay! That's unexpected. And as I was telling you off camera before we started recording, like, a lot of what you do in your work relates to so much of what has come up for me in this podcast, in the conversations I've been having with people about whether reading and literature produces social change. Social change for who, or what are the assumptions behind that premise, the idea that reading can produce empathy or reading across differences good? Like you said, you're looking at both the assumptions and the possibilities of that kind of thing. Like, it sounds like you're both being critical of that premise, but also honoring the possibilities within that premise. Is that right to say?
Yeah. And one of the things I really notice is, I mean, I'm so bad at giving a description of my work briefly. Like, I tend to freeze when someone asks, and what's your dissertation on? And, you know, if I get out, I'm looking at books and social change, people often go, oh yeah, books, like, and social change, like, and are so excited about it. And then right. I feel like such a pessimist going back and going, but
yeah, exactly.
I'm not so sure.
Yeah, being like, wait a minute. That's maybe not where I'm going with this. Like, I'm taking a critical approach to it. And other things, I'm sure, other things with that topic. Yeah. Well, it can just be so, especially for people who grew up being book lovers and white women, if I can say and add on to what you're saying, white women who grow up being book lovers and believing it often harmfully in the sort of possibilities of reading for quote unquote helping communities who are marginalized or communities who are oppressed, like even that whole helping discourse that we learn about through and alongside reading, like it can feel so idealistic and it can feel so life-changing, but there's such troubling, you know, disconcerting assumptions and impulses and attitudes and biases that are underneath a lot of that.
Yeah. And I would say that, I hold alongside that the reality that reading novels, reading fiction, going to plays, watching movies has often spurred on a search for knowledge and things that I didn't know about. And I'm glad I learned about. So, like, that's Absolutely. Also true. Mm-hmm. And I'm also grateful that I get to bang up against my own ignorance in a book so much of the time first before I do in front of a real person, right? Like, I'd rather confront the issues in my beliefs while I'm reading a book than in having harmed a real person through something I've said or done. Not that reading a book stops those things from happening, but I'm also grateful for the shelter learning within books can provide. But yes, a whole bunch of assumptions go along with it about the impact that has in the world, right? Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's really interesting. Like, I feel like I always kind of have thought that, but you just articulated it so well, this idea that reading can be a way of sort of engaging with something that's different from you in a way that hopefully minimizes the harm you could cause through that engagement or something like that. So I guess all of this really does lead into why you're here, which is to talk about a couple of things. It's to talk about this book called The Kappa Child, which I'll let you describe in a second if you like. You're also here to talk about your experiences reading The Kappa Child in a book club. So I'm not sure which is easier, but I was thinking maybe first you could talk about your book club experiences in general, just sort of set the scene for those who for those who might want to know.
Yeah. So part of what I think when I was thinking through this, I actually thought was funny. It was like, okay, so when did I start engaging with a book club? And it was actually while between my master's and my PhD, when I was at home with my newborn daughter and my partner was away at school for the year. So I was like at home alone with the baby. And I'm like, wow, this is the stereotype of why white women go to book clubs. But it was very true. And it was actually a really lovely experience. And it was a way for me to go be with other people, have other people who would hold the baby. And we'd talk about books. And it was great emotional support in that way. And so much life knowledge in the room and such a wealth of reading. These are people who have read their entire lives, just a really lovely, supportive group to be in at that stage in my life. At the same time, it was a moment of realizing over the course of the year that, oh, these are different interpretive practices than I've so been intensely, because your master's degree, at least for me, was such an intense, like, adjust to this, like, academic way of being. So, like, having come out of doing that for a year and then going back into a more casual reading atmosphere and noticing the differences in the way we were reading, not quite knowing how to engage my academic self in this atmosphere and what value it had or not, being confused about what books to suggest. And at the same time, noticing that one of the privileges of being in the academic sphere, while it is definitely its own bubble, at least the academic sphere I'd been coming out of at UVic had people approaching literature from a variety of perspectives. And when I was in a book club atmosphere, in this book club, I've gone on to be in some other contexts, everyone was very much coming from the same background. All white women, all my mother's age or slightly older, all middle class. So noticing that this is a different atmosphere and it's the academic bubble is still a bubble. This is a different bubble and could sometimes act as an echo chamber in the way people were reading. I can talk a bit more about some of the specificities of that later when we talk about the book maybe, but this experience really convinced me that as I was going into my PhD, I wanted to keep engaging with like what I came to think about as like real people reading books. Because there was a part of me that felt like, well, in some ways it's way more important what people outside the academy are using books for. Their opinions travel more widely. They influence their children, their grandchildren, day-to-day conversations, what they believe about the world more than anything I'm going to write in academia is going to like get out to anybody outside the academic bubble. So just, it really was I want to stay engaged with this. So then I made a point of going to actually two other book clubs developed over the course of my PhD. Of course, I could not attend all of these all the time, but I've made a point of going to them. Some of them are more diverse in terms of who attends them than others, both racially and in terms of whether people have grown up in Canada or not. Linguistically, one of them has several people who English is not their first language, which is a place where I definitely noticed how some of the books I would be like excited about introducing are really difficult if English is not your first language. Socioeconomically, not very diverse. All of them, all women. But I've also made a point of attending when Laurier has a like Laurier Reads kind of thing, as well as there's a prof from UW who led a kind of branch off of Pam Pometer's, Reconciliation Book Club. And I was only able to attend two of those. But those are some examples of the book club atmosphere. But I would really say that there are other kinds of book clubs. But the majority of my book club experiences have been with kind of that stereotypical demographic of white women reading. And that's definitely where some of my contentions and also hopes come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see how coming out of that particular book club background would present to you certain paths about thinking about the book club context, even while you're also working to work against the stereotypes of the particular book clubs you've come out of. When you said something about, I don't know, real people reading books, it reminded me of how, as I've said to you, like I just joined a book club for the first time in my life this year. And it's like given me permission to be a real person reading books. Like that sounds really gross, as if I thought I was just like an academic, like high on my horse, but that's not true at all. I actually think I had sort of boxed myself in to damagingly to myself to certain ways of thinking about books and reading. And so even when I read for leisure, so to speak, complicated phrase, even when I did that, I was still always boxing myself in into this way of reading that might not have been the way that I actually want to read. So reading in this Alice Munro book club that I've been part of has sort of given me the permission to just be a real person who reads books, which means I can just come to the book club and be like, I didn't like that. I did like that. I hated that character. Nothing needs to like be behind that other than my feelings. And a lot of my reading in that book club is therefore really different from the kinds that I've learned in academia that have, to me, felt a little bit restrictive sometimes, have boxed me in. And that's probably partly just myself. It's not like anyone standing over my shoulder when I'm reading saying like, no, you must read that through the lens of this theory. But yeah. In my head, I've been sort of, I think, boxed into use particular interpretive practices that now I feel freed from a little bit. So actually my book club experience has been quite like freeing, or like it has liberated me.
And I actually, one of the things I was thinking about when we were going to discuss this book in the context of book clubs was about how like I originally read this book when I was looking for books to put together a dissertation proposal. So it was automatically, does this book work with my theories? And then when I sat down to talk about it with a book club, realizing there were so many things in the book I missed, partly because of that, which is kind of like, it's a little sad. But it was also partly because I knew who had written on it. So it's like, Larissa Lai talks about Hiromi Gocho in The Slanting Eye. So automatically I read this book and then I'm going to read what she says. That's not that you shouldn't read what she says. Actually, awesome context for the book. And that's not, I'm not saying you shouldn't read it, but I'm saying I didn't do any, how am I reacting to this book? Mm-hmm. In the middle, I did very little of that. And that's actually, maybe this is idealistic of me, but I actually think something's lost from the academic conversation if I just jump to what all the academics have said about it and haven't stopped to go, how am I responding to this book? Because that says something about the work the book is doing. Mm-hmm. If I take that time to look at the book in relation to me before I go and find out what all the official people have said.
Yeah, that's very relatable. Like, I just feel like academia has been this sort of transformation for me from, I always would do that for sure. Like, I would read a book for school and then I would go and see what everybody more official, like you said, had to say about it, because certainly I could not have an original idea first. Like, I wouldn't prioritize my own thoughts and ideas and reactions to the book. And then growing out of that and realizing that, like, oh no, shit, I have my own thoughts before I even enter the scholarly conversation, which is its own important process to enter that conversation if you're in academia. Before I even do that, I actually do have my own thoughts. I can be an official person too. So,
yeah.
I was just going to say, you already kind of started talking about this book in the relation to the book club. So did you want to say a little bit about the book and how you came to read the book in this book club that you're part of?
Sure. So, I've practiced summarizing this book several times. And it's quite difficult. So, here's my attempt.
Great.
So the story is about a potentially nameless, I can come back to that later, pronounless narrator. It was written in the first person. Who has become pregnant or believes they have come pregnant with the baby of a kappa, which is a Japanese water sprite. The only thing is that this pregnancy never comes to fruition. The only evidence of it is the narrator's feeling in their own body of another presence and movement, sometimes not even in their uterus, elsewhere in their body. And they've also been diagnosed with a hysterical pregnancy because of this. This narrator is the second child of four children of parents who immigrated from Japan to BC, had very limited temporary work there, and the father was able to buy a farm somehow in Alberta, where he decides he's going to be the first person to grow Japanese rice on the prairies, very dry and windblown, windswept climate. The father is also emotionally and physically abusive. And so part of the narrator's journey throughout the book is also the memories that are coming up for them about their childhood and abuse and their relationship with their father, who they also really admire at the same time as he is abusive, and trying to manage their relationship with their sisters, all of whom are dealing with trauma in their own ways, and their relationship with their mother, who they have perceived as very weak at different times. Spaced out throughout the novel, there are these short sections that appear to be the kappa talking, the kappa baby talking. So it begins with an egg and grows to a fetus and is moving around in the body and having their own existential thoughts about what it means to be an egg and in relationship to sisters. The narrator is quite self-deprecating. You could say very low self-esteem. Describes themselves as extremely ugly in these very vivid ways, like with sausage fingers and a pumpkin head and pumpkin teeth and square body, and talks passingly about suicide, but I would never talk about that. I would never think about that. Very self-deprecating, not easy to pin down what they really think. At the same time, this narrator is immensely delighted in the things they delight in. So you have, they wear pajamas all the time because that's what fits their body and they feel good about that. And they have pajamas for all occasion. And they are impregnated by the kappa because they insist on going to see the lunar eclipse and won't go with anybody who doesn't fully embrace the idea of it. Though their friends aren't really interested in it. And so this kappa appears to them, seemingly out of nowhere, and they sumo wrestle together, which is, I guess, what you do with a kappa, and end up pregnant. So there's this immense creativity and delight alongside the self-deprecation of the narrator through this journey as they search for a connection to other people with their sisters, search for romantic love as well. And I guess the other element of the story is there are kappa stories throughout the narration that the parents tell. I guess that would be the gist of the novel. I left out anything.
No, that was amazing.
There's a lot going on.
It's such a complex, complicated novel that goes forward and back in time, like flashbacks to the narrator's youth. There is that other narrative voice, like you said, that seems to be the kappa child speaking or expressing itself through thought or that sort of thing. Like, it's so complex. And so everything you, I'm just really impressed by the summary because it's so hard to encapsulate in, you know, in a few sentences for sure. So. Do I remember correctly that you chose this book for your book club? Like, this is your pick? Okay.
Yes, it was. It was my pick. And it's actually, there's so much going on in the novel that kind of made me pick it. So I'll give some context. I've been very bad at picking book novels. So, or not even novels, like, because sometimes you read things that aren't novels. So, like, for example, I chose Dancing on Our Turtle's Back for a book club because I loved that book and it was very eye-opening for me. And this was a group that definitely approaches reading as a learning about what it means, learning about being in the world, learning about what it means to be a citizen in Canada, or what, there's definitely an idea of we're doing this to learn. And I thought this is a great book about that, that could help with that. But it has footnotes. And it's not that people didn't like it. People liked it, but it was a lot of work, understandably. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, right, I read like this all day, every day. This book actually seems more accessible than like Derrida or something. Because there are footnotes that explain what she's saying. And then I also chose Green Grass Running Water, thinking this won Canada Reads. And then the discussion around that was, so can you explain it to us? Like, this is the kind of book that I'd love to read in a class. And fair enough. Like, so I'm not, like, fair enough. I have to Google 9 million things to understand what's going on in Green Grass Running Water. But I am excited to do that. I'm also, that's also my work. So I have time to do that. That's not the same as I'm reading on the side of other things. So I was really struggling to find a book that would prompt questions, because part of what I had hoped about Green Grass Running Water, part of what I find excited about that book is the questions that come up, like, why is Susanna Moody getting off a bus? Like, what? but needing it to also be accessible. And again, it sounds condescending when I say that, but I would perceive this as just coming from different interpretive practices and from different atmospheres.
I even think about that with myself, like what books are more accessible or less accessible to me. Absolutely. So totally. And also for students, and it's not something that's just applicable outside of academia. Like it's
makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I continually felt like I was bumping up against in a book club context, in particular, when we're reading to learn about social, like this idea of I'm going to read and learn about someone else so that I know more about a real social situation, and doing that through fiction, is that we would get stuck in ruts, I think. And in particular, this rut has to do with, I would describe it as having to do with the emotion of the book. So you go in knowing I'm going to read about a hard topic. It's going to be hard. And you feel it, you read about it, you learn about the hard or bad things that happened, and that's the work. The work is reading the book and feeling it, and then we might in a book club discuss how horrible it is, how awful it is, and maybe get to the point of discussing how that relates to our lives, but sometimes not. And feeling like that sometimes results in not doing justice to the book as a literary work that is actually in and of itself evidence of creativity and resilience and looking for different ways of being in the world, being in community. And in particular, when you're in a group, a book club group, where everyone is coming from the same relatively privileged position, trying to read about someone else, but you're empathy is maybe being expressed more as pity, and finding myself caught up in that too, and looking for books that I thought maybe could just turn the conversation in a different direction, almost like if we read a different book, maybe I'll be a more effective person in the conversation. And so The Kappa Child was one of those books I turned to, and the reason was because it has that narrative that you could read. Right. If it was on its own, you could read the story of family immigrates from Japan to Canada, doesn't have access to work, doesn't have access to supports. There's abuse in the family. There's not access to what the family needs. Everyone's dealing with the trauma and the outfall of that, and the narrator's moving on to find relationships. You could read that story in there, except, and it is there, except it is there alongside a narrator who is so both self-deprecating, but also delightful and delighted, and has like almost this cosmic agency to like get pregnant under a lunar eclipse with a mystical creature. Mm-hmm. My hope was that we could both talk about things like Japanese internment are mentioned in the book, racism and homophobia, pathologizing individuals based on whether it's queerness or based on experiences of trauma, that some of those things can come up, but not let us get into this like pity rut of discussion. Mm-hmm. And I would say that for the most part, that was successful. And that's why I want to talk about this book, because I was excited by the ways this combination of like delight and what we're this narrative that sometimes turns to pity work together, I think, to turn us back to the literariness of the book and asking more questions about what's going on in the text as something that is working in the world.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me like what you're saying is like the choice of book actually does, it's not like book clubs or your book club experience. It's not like it's the same every single time. When you have the same group, like it's always going to be the same dynamic. It sounds to me like what you're saying is there's some power in the choice of book, and that books actually, the choice of book can lead you towards different paths. Would you say, or is that almost overstating it?
I would say it's almost overstating it. Like it's kind of was like my last hope. It was like, if I can choose a book that bridges different ways of reading, so bridges like the affective approach of I feel sad and light at the same time. So if through the feelings of these book, I can be led to a kind of confusion that leads me to ask more questions, that might work. But I would also say, like, one of your questions was what makes a good book club book?
Yeah.
And I guess I'm a little struck by what you said, because when I was thinking about that question, I was like, well, it doesn't matter what you read. It matters how you read it. Mm-hmm. And, but I totally was turning to, I was feeling so stuck that I was like, okay, well, maybe I just need to choose something different. So I think it can, like, it's my hope. My hope is that we can read different things differently, but there's always the risk. I think the stamp of this isn't a good book is the like cutting off. Like that's just an end to the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. That's it's kind of an unhelpful conversation, but I imagine that probably happens quite a bit in book clubs. You have way more experience than I do with them. The reason why I wanted to follow up on that portion of what you had just said, though, is because I've been thinking about this matter of whether the book matters in a book club or not. Like you just said, okay, that your approach is generally like the book doesn't matter. It matters how you read it. But the reason I've been thinking about this is because in my Alice Munro book club, where we're only reading Alice Munro, there's been a lot of discussion about how Munro's writing in particular is fostering more complex, complicated discussions in our book club. So that's people's views. And in fact, I've been caught up in those views myself. And I've said that, like, oh yeah, I think there's something really complex about her worldview where she doesn't sort of reduce things to good or bad. There's a lot of moral complexity in her writing. And I think that's fostering a different dynamic in the book club. And other folks have definitely said that in the book club. And so that's something I've been thinking about is there certain books that lend themselves to particular book club contexts or not? And I guess it's the same as teaching and learning. Like some people say there are unteachable texts, but I have a feeling that you might disagree with that given what you have just said, is that maybe there's just ways to approach a text differently so that it becomes a text that can foster conversation perhaps. But I know that I've heard growing up in academia, I've heard many times, this is an unteachable text, like for different books out there. So that's why I was asking you that in short, just because I'm curious about the real significance of the books themselves to the conversations that happen around them in book clubs or elsewhere.
Well, I do wonder, like, so if I'm thinking about this, part of what both the book clubs I read this book with were white middle-class book clubs, women, and part of what I liked, so I guess part of what I'm saying is, it's the book, but then it's probably also the book playing off the context, right? So part of what I actually found, so what was interesting or I thought took us out of some of our interpretive patterns with the book was the way people responded to some of the strange parts in the book. So like, if we just begin with the kappa, like what is a kappa? Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes. Tell me more about all of that, all these details. Yeah.
So for example, needing to Google what a kappa is. And like, mm-hmm. this happened to me too. So when I read the book for the first time, I'm like, kappa, I've heard of that before. It's in Harry Potter. Like, that's my frame of reference. So people had a context for what a kappa is based on their children and grandchildren having read Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. But then if you Google it, and people did this, right? What's a kappa? Then you're suddenly exposed to, oh my gosh, in Japan, there's tons of pop culture references to kappa. Mm-hmm. There's, besides like the folklore, this is actually a thing. This is a big thing. So part of what I liked about that is it's suddenly like, oh, this isn't just about me reading as a Canadian in a Canadian context about someone who's had an experience of being Canadian different than mine. Mm-hmm. This is also participating in a transnational narrative in a different, and so whether you understand that narrative or not, you at least get the, like, it was interesting to me to have people reacting and saying like, I had no idea. Just that's a simple, like, out of my context thing, but at least it, you know, gets us out of what is often a national, like, little bubble of how reading is done. Mm-hmm. So that was exciting to me. And then one of the things that was exciting was someone brought, and I should have looked this up so I could speak to it more clearly, a blog written by someone who had, when they were looking up kappa, came across someone who was blogging about their own love of Harry Potter. This is before everything that's currently going on with
okay.
love of Harry Potter, but her use of an idea from a Southern American Indigenous group, a group in the Southern United States, in her, like, in the online Harry Potter stuff. Mm-hmm. And so this was someone responding to, like, hey, I love Harry Potter, but I'm really not comfortable with you using a piece of my culture. And that was interesting for me, because then suddenly I was like, this is really interesting. Now we're going off on the use of kappa and what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So I was excited by that conversation. That was actually the first thing that happened, because the first thing I asked about was, what do people know about kappas? Is this something you're familiar with?
I was just going to say, and that's its own kind of labor, right? Like, I think earlier in my notes here that I just wrote as you were talking, you're talking about the worry that, like, reading becomes the work. Like, if you're reading to learn and you just, in the ruts that you got into in your book club, if I can say that, it ended up being like, just reading is simply the work that we must do. But if you're reading, but also doing sort of side research, that at least seems to add on to the work, so to speak, like maybe like Dion Brand's struggle work. I know Joanne Liao talked about this in another episode of the podcast, the idea of reading as labor, but then also the other labor that needs to go into that in order to possibly make real social change. Well, Googling, I think, would be considered probably by many people a passive kind of just a more passive form of labor. To me, I think there's still radical possibilities in just the simple act of looking things up and access to information. But that sounds to me like another whole layer of labor on top of the labor of reading that's happening in your book club.
Yeah. And so that's like, and I'm not saying, like, I do not claim that this leads to social change really at all, but I am talking about, like, just getting out of interpretive ruts as like a step.
Totally. And that
probably has to do with the context in which I'm reading, in which I'm doing this reading. But actually where I found, like, the most productive was the Little House on the Prairie reference. The
book. Yes. I wanted you to talk about that. Like, yes.
Yeah. So in a book club context, and I'm speaking from myself here too, having grown up with the Little House books, that actually one of the things I so valued about our conversation around this book is that because there was this Little House narrative where I'll explain that a bit.
Yes, please.
People haven't read the book. So the narrator's book throughout favorite book, which they actually carry with them as they move to the prairies, is Little House on the Prairie. And they, like, hold it in their shirt. And they have dreams in which they are Laura. And the relationship between Laura and Mary is really mirrored in the difficult relationship the narrator has with their older sister, Slither, mm-hmm. Who's beautiful and the good one, but also the weak one. And they're continually comparing, as a child, their relationship between what's going on for their family and what happens when Laura's family moves to the prairies. So that includes like, well, Pa would never hit Ma, but like, I don't know, maybe he would. And there's a moment when, so one of the traumatic and difficult things for the narrator is that when they're sleeping all in the same room, their parents have sex, which is mm-hmm. not only disturbing, but it's also disturbing because their father is so abusive to their mother. And the narrator has a moment of, well, Laura's family lived in a log cabin. She must have experienced that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Laura becomes quite a grotesque figure at different points. And is emaciated and walks out of the television as a ghost at one point. That's like, I forget the name of the actress who plays Laura in the Little House television show. That was a little before my growing up time. So the prairie narrative is troubled, like this idea of pioneering and prairie narratives mm-hmm. troubled. And that was such a good distraction from focusing on the pity, the potential ability to pity this narrator who's like maybe delusional, instead like going, okay, but I love Little House on the Prairie. Yeah, no, I haven't read that in however many years. Probably doesn't read the same today as it did when I was 10. What would happen if I went back to read that? So almost how this narrative of this, the narrative within the book where they're using Little House on the Prairie as a way to interact and understand their own experience and as a comforting thing, but also the text, the Little House text becomes increasingly troubled and people bringing up how difficult that is and encountering their own, like, that was something I easily accepted. So it's mm-hmm. almost as though this diasporic text became a text about settler colonialism in our reading discussions. And because people were so emotionally attached to Laura and Little House on the Prairie. So that was an awesome emotional distraction from our reading patterns. And it worked on an emotional level, right? People weren't going at this from, now I'm going to talk about the allusions to Little House on the Prairie in the book. It was, I emotionally responded to this because it is a part of my growing up experience. And then that led to questions and discussion. And I, book club, you normally don't come out with like a thesis statement in the end, mm-hmm. but that's the work partly, right? Like sometimes I wonder if our thesis statements are more about like our academic position. See, I came up with a thesis statement.
Oh,
like,
God,
the
yes.
thesis statement isn't the work. The work is the coming up with a thesis statement, mm-hmm. right? And so I was excited by that.
The Little House on the Prairie stuff, I was really hoping you'd bring that up because not only is it a text I grew up with, like I said, it's also, it's such a powerful intertext in the novel, as you said, and it obviously mm-hmm. gripped your book club members. And I thought, like, this kind of just echoes what you're saying, but I thought the narrator's working out, like hard working out of their relationship with that text, The Little House on the Prairie, kind of, especially in terms of relatability versus unrelatability, like, or what they yeah. feel is similar between them and Laura and what they feel is not similar between them and Laura's experience of the prairie. All of that sounds like what's also happening to some degree in either in your book club or in the reading practices that a lot of us take towards books, right? This sort of back and forth between a text and ourselves, thinking what in here is seeing me and I see it, and what in here is unfamiliar to me. So that microcosm that we see in the text of the narrator working out their relationship to this text and this key figure, Laura Ingalls, seems to me as kind of like a broader, I don't know, it says something more about the larger interpretive practices that we use to figure out text and to have our own emotional responses to text.
Yeah. And I think too, if we're talking about like not wanting to invalidate like personal reading practices, we'll still be critical of them. Like the work the narrator is doing is very, very personal, right? About their own relationship to life and to their family. And so, yeah, I like the way those two things are held together in the text. a downfall of the way we were reading and the way the discussion went definitely was that some of, like, for example, the discussion of Little House on the Prairie, like wanting to make sure that we don't lose also the discussion of the racism and homophobia that the narrator mm-hmm. experiences. Yeah. So definitely the narrator's struggle and self-deprecation kept coming up. And what do we really make of that? There was quite a long discussion about, are they really contemplating suicide? Yeah. Another interesting thing was just people had their phones out and we were trying to Google some of the Japanese sayings, which Google interpretation, I had asked a friend who speaks Japanese about a couple things, but Google Translator is only so good. But that in and of itself is like sitting together doing struggle work going, okay, none of us understand Japanese. None of us speak Japanese. So what does that mean to like not just skim over it, you know?
And to go to Google and have this like insufficient response come back to you. Like it's such a, like just reading that metaphorically is interesting. Yeah. Like thinking about how you're attempting to do like labor beyond reading, but then getting not a perfect sort of polished result coming back to you, which is such a good metaphor for the labor of reading and the reading towards social change. I guess people can't see my scare quotes here, but scare quotes reading for social change, that it doesn't just like, it's not like pop in a book and out pops social change, right? It's, and like you said, that's the premise of basically your work around reading and social change. So, but that Google Translate example seems to like metaphorize, is that a word? Make that metaphorical in some way. Yeah. So do you have other examples that you wanted to share or?
Well, there are things that I just didn't like. I appreciated some of the questions, how honest people were about their confusion about some points of the book without giving the like, which I had a bit of with Green Grass Running Water, Tom King's better than this. Why isn't he explaining it more clearly? That didn't really happen with this book, which is interesting. I think it was just that much more accessible because there was a through narrative. Mm-hmm. But things like the youngest sister barking like a dog. And this one thing where it's just barking like a dog. It's another thing when the youngest sister chases after a ghost snarling and barking like a dog. And it says her hackles, is that the word, were raised on the back. And it's like, okay, is this actually a sister? I think it is because they ride their bike. But is this a dog or is it a sister or is it a dog? I'm not sure. Right. So like, and those are funny moments. They relieve the tension of other, but people really wondering and looking through the book going, where is the evidence, right? Where's the evidence that says if this is a person or a dog? And the same with the alien abductions. I'm not sure I mentioned this yet. The mother is abducted by aliens. Maybe.
Right. Like, I don't know what is true or not in this book. And I'm not concerned with that. Of course, I know, like, because of my own reading practices that I'm not there to, like, you know, find the truth or whatever with my magnifying glass. Yeah. But I am aware that this book felt like a fever dream in some ways. Like, I'm like, what was real? What was not real? The boundaries between real and not real are definitely played with.
Right. And I think that's actually part of, so in a reading practice where you're reading a book to learn about people like this person in this book and their real experience, I think that's part of the book's potential, right? Is it's like, I don't know what's real or not real in this book. And I'm going to choose to trust that this narrator, who is incredibly confusing, is communicating their experience.
Yeah. It like destabilizes the very pursuit of definite knowledge, which is so perfect for a book club, perhaps, or for other contexts too, where you're trying to pin down something or trying to pin down knowledge about someone else.
Yeah. No, and I think, and so the at the end of the book, there's this, I think this mirrors the conclusion the narrator has to get to, who is also unsure about their mother's experience and their sister's experience and their own experience. The narrator has to come to, at least as I interpret it, an understanding and acceptance that other people have experiences different than them. Mm-hmm. So their sister, their older sister, who they don't get along with that well in childhood, has just gone to counseling, has a partner, has a life that the narrator doesn't even know about. And that older sister is telling the narrator, you need to accept that our mother does believe she's being abducted by aliens and has found friends and community who accept that. And it's good for her, you're going to need to accept that. It's good mm-hmm. for her. So it's not a permission to accept the father's abuse as mm-hmm. an okay thing, or the ways in which the narrator is very lonely because their way of being in the world is not accepted. Rather, it's, at least as I read the book, partly an acceptance that people do experience the world differently. And if it's mm-hmm. working for them, they're not hurting anyone else. Right? How do we be in a relationship? And I think that's part of what the narrator is struggling with. I do think book clubs can get stuck in ruts of reading the same text, so variety can be good. But when I was thinking about this question, the main thing I was thinking about was the situations I've been in where, like, I've actually seen people leave book clubs often after, like, it's one thing to leave a book club. It's another thing to leave a book club after your book hasn't been, like, was kind of nay-nayed kind of thing. Like, that's not good. And so just wondering about how personal it is. Like, and you think about this when you, like, recommend a movie to someone and then you go, like, did I mean to recommend that movie to somebody? Gosh. Right. So when people bring books to a book club setting, it's often because they're personal, right? It's not the same as when you teach. It's like, going to teach this book. I know half the class will hate it, but that's not the point, mm-hmm. right? Or maybe I don't like this book, but I'm going to teach it because it's important historically for this reason. But people often choose books that are very personal to them. And then when people in the book club don't recognize the value of the book, but it's done important work for you, that's very personal for people. And I actually think that that's one of the ways, like, I wish that there was a way to make that experience visible on a larger reading industry scale, because I think that's also what happens, right? So mm-hmm. if white women are the main force in the reading industry in terms of their buying power and what is catered to and tastes, what does that mean about what is expressed and popularized in literature about many other people's experiences? So, I guess where I'm going with this is less about what makes a good book club selection, though I think diversity is a good idea in every sense in terms of what you're reading and who's writing it. That the atmosphere in which you're reading, I actually think, is really important. Mm-hmm. So instead of asking, is this a good book or not a good book? You can say you don't like the book, but there's a difference between I don't like the book and this is not a good book. I'm not going to say this isn't a good book, right? I'm going to discuss what's going on with this book and be interested as to why other people like it, or mm-hmm. interested as to why other people see value or importance in that book. Mm-hmm. That being more important than what a book selection is chosen.
Yeah, that's, I think this is such a, it feels to me just as a book club newbie, like a uncharted sort of maybe or unspoken about like thing where it's like the feelings that can be hurt from when you bring this book that's maybe beloved to you into a book club and you're like, okay guys, here you go. And it's like that moment when you like are showing a friend a movie you really love and you like have to stare at them because you're like, do they love it too? Right. But and then the crushing feeling that can happen when people don't respond to the book in the same way you do, because it's sort of like sharing a part of yourself. So that's such a awesome thing to bring up here, because of course those those personal feelings, reactions that we might want to kind of submerge sometimes. I know certainly I sometimes try to like play it cool if I'm too eager about something. Those can inform the dynamics of the group. It can inform whether you stay in or leave a group. It can inform the community practices. Like, oh, what if you notice that somebody's feelings were hurt? Maybe the next time you totally do something different, or you now treat that person more preciously. Like, these are all things that to me seem to go a little bit unspoken, or maybe aren't explicitly talked about. Maybe they are in your book club, but
no, definitely not.
Seem to have a huge impact on the dynamics of the group and the dynamics of the reading that happens. So I'm really glad that you brought that up.
Mm-hmm. And I think like it doesn't mean you don't point out problems in books, right? Mm-hmm. At all. It's just when people are reacting and valuing books based on their emotional value, just have to keep that in mind. And that it is often the person who has the individual, more personal experience, right? Who has that, right? So
mm-hmm. when you're reading a book that comes from your community, let's say, or from like the exact place and people that you grew up with, that can be, that can create tensions and that can create like eagerness and enthusiasm in ways that maybe we wouldn't see from book club picks that we're detached from.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is something we've talked about quite a bit along the way. And I know your research focuses a lot on this kind of thing, but I wanted to ask you about, again, I guess, I feel like, again, we've talked about this, but I did want to ask you about the possibilities or maybe the limitations of book clubs as teaching and learning contexts.
So I think the main limitation in many ways is the way they can end up like echo chambers, in particular, if everyone's from similar backgrounds, regardless of what you're reading, you might read it all the same way. And then we're not moving anywhere. And you might be learning some things, but there's limitations on that. But I do think, and I guess we did touch on this, the main possibility, I think, is the ability to be vulnerable. And I absolutely think we need spaces like that in order for our learning to not be so laborious for other people. So I think that's a good possibility. But I think when I also think there is... and this is branching out, maybe this is too big theoretically for what our discussion today, but in a settler colonial Canadian context, like to be aware that this idea that we create community from books is like a very old, longstanding colonial practice. And like, I mean, Fanon says it very clearly, that when the colonial state is challenged, everyone will turn to Western culture. Like, and so there is something glaring about that. That's right. I see a problem in the world, I'm going to read a book. Well, that's nice, but the land, access to resources, right to practice your culture, right to exist, those are the issues, not whether you've read a book or not. And so like that's, I don't know, for me, that's haunting underneath all our reading practices. When we're reading for social change, that to me is underneath there and to be aware of. And I haven't quite found ways to discuss that necessarily with people in different contexts, because that's not to say reading isn't personal work, and reading can't be transformative. And at the same time, that's not to say that people like Daniel Heath Justice aren't saying Indigenous literatures matter because Indigenous lives matter, right? But that's a different kind of community that's being formed. So how do you hold those things in tension? That reading provides a space if your voice, if your experience is not being held within what is being called the Canadian community, that literatures can provide a space where alternative communities can grow and hear each other and support each other and perhaps lead to working for change, that also needs to be held in tension with this like longstanding practice of building national culture through reading and through imagining that in reading about this other person, I am enacting my citizenship.
Like the Benedict Anderson thing, like that, you know, that whole portion of his book, Imagined Communities, is about print culture and how those ideas circulate through print. And yet at the same time, and you're sort of holding this complexity for us, but at the same time, you know, storytelling as a far, process, a far earlier practice of relationality and community building from Indigenous folks who have been on these lands for time immemorial and for other folks. So storytelling as a community building practice that has always been around, but print and nationalism and books and reading as a white settler. Yeah, all of those things are doing something maybe a little bit different or...
Yeah, for me, I think it has to do with what... So if I am looking for, if I have had an experience and I am looking for community, if I've had an experience that seems to be outside of, that isn't being acknowledged, and I find in a book, I find community, I find other people reading that book, and telling their stories, being inspired to tell their stories by reading that book, that has a resistance to it, right? And I think that does have an ability to create change. But I think, I guess, and I'm saying this tentatively, I haven't totally thought it through, but I do think there's a difference between that and I'm going to learn about someone else through a book without any real, necessarily any real acknowledgement of my relationship or positionality in relation to the subject I'm reading about. And that's more where I'm seeing, I think there's a lot of assumptions in there.
Totally. I just actually read a piece about this, and I'll put it in the show notes because I can't remember the title of it, but it was a piece coming out of all of the reading lists and the book clubs that have come out of George Floyd's murder and resulting increases and increased visibility of racial justice and protests for racial justice. But this was published in October 2020, and the writer was saying, like, all of this just reduces these really complex systemic racial capitalist issues into self-work. Mm-hmm. It's always about self-work. And so, yeah, I think that I'll put the link to that in the show notes, and that seems to be what you're hesitant about, is this idea that through reading, that is the work of learning about another person, that self-work, when there's actually larger things to keep in mind.
I was going to say, there was kind of an explosion of articles and exploration of that, I think, over the past year, which is interesting while so many of us were at home doing self-work.
Totally. Yeah. Yes. I mean, oh gosh, we haven't even brought up the idea of, like, how book clubs have changed during COVID and the self-work and the reading work that's changing during COVID. I did want to make sure I asked, like, so we've talked about the Kappa Child in relation to book clubs and your book club, but do you think, or maybe you've already seen this happen and maybe you've done it yourself, how do you think the Kappa Child translates to sort of traditional teaching and learning context? Like, can you see it working well in an undergraduate literature class?
Yeah, actually, I think one of the, I'll use my brother as an example here, as a non-professional reader example, who I very much admire. So my brother reads a lot of Neil Gaiman, that kind of thing. And so, like, I was trying to get him a book that, like, somehow remotely intersects with what I do. And so I got him Eden Robinson's Son of a Trickster, thinking that he also lives out west. So some of these uses of fantasy, but then also similar genre elements, but then also grounded actually close to where he lives, would be interesting. And I think that the Kappa Child would also fit into that. So thinking about undergraduate students who read a lot of fantasy, that this would be a way in to some other discussions. I also think there is enough critical work on it that you could bring in some critical discussion. So I do think the Kappa Child would provide some, would work in a traditional learning class. And I also think it brings some questions up about, I have some unanswered questions about the ending of the book, and in particular, the relationship with Gerald, that comes up in terms of what is the relationship to the land and what is the relationship to Indigenous presence at the end of the book. I'm not really sure. I think those would be great conversations to have in a class at the end of the book, about the end of the book. And I would welcome that. So, but I do think that you're approaching it differently in a classroom, because I think it's a different strategy of learning from a book. In the book club context, I was kind of hoping and relying on us going at the book affectively. What is your personal affective experience of the book? And that leading to questions. And not that that doesn't have a place in the classroom, but in the classroom, in a way, I wouldn't in a book club. It would be, so Larissa Lai says this about the book. Nancy Kang says this about the book. I saw this review of the book. How does it relate to this other concept, right? It's a different way of learning. Yeah.
And that actually does get into a question I had for you more personally. And we did talk about this a little bit already, but do you feel like there's, like, a switch in you that switches from PhD reading to book club reading, or leisure reader, casual reader to professional reader? We've been using these terms a few times throughout our conversation, and I know we probably both think of them as very unstable terms, and we're not using them, like, we're not investing in them fully. But I did want to ask you, just because of my own experiences, like I told you, I kind of have built up within myself this academic reader who doesn't read in a way that I probably naturally want to. So I'm wondering if you have that sort of similar things, that similar process. Like, do you notice the differences in the ways that you read or the interpretive strategies you have between being a PhD candidate in literature, being a book club reader, or other reading roles?
I don't, if it's a book that I haven't read before. I don't take notes when I read for a book club. And
I'm laughing just because your face almost looked like you were like revealing a secret or something.
But the problem is other people at the book club do.
Okay.
Like, every book club, like, because there's three that I've attended fairly regularly, do. And I often feel like I'm the person that going, I don't have a page number for this. Everyone else has a page number. But it's like, it's actually part of enjoyment for me, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not going to take notes because it's so much work to take notes. I do it all the time. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the enjoyment, not taking notes. So I do, when I'm reading for a book club, choose to experience the book, partly so I can engage in the conversation. Mm-hmm. Because if I've just analyzed the book, I haven't given credence to the part of myself that actually can and does read in the way other people in the room are reading. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so it is a different way of reading. And I think I didn't say this, but I do think we need to be cognizant of the fact that, like, things like Canada Reads, like, book clubs are really modeled for us. Oprah, like, this isn't a neutral out of nowhere thing. This is something that is marketed and modeled. Mm-hmm. And so just being aware of that. And I mean, Daniel Coleman's concept of rye civility really gets at that, mm-hmm. though he's not talking specifically to book clubs. I do think we do need a certain amount of rye civility without throwing out the validation that literature does produce emotional responses in readers. And that's okay. That's part of book's magic.
This episode was recorded on Treaty 6 territory and the homeland of the Métis. In March 2021, the Saskatchewan Library Association is putting on the 5th annual One Book, One Province Book Club, or Reading Challenge of sorts. And this year's Reading Challenge, or Book Club, or Project, features the book Blanket Toss Under Midnight Sun by Saskatoon-based Willow Cree author Paul Sisiquesis. The SLA website describes the program as one that, quote, aims to increase literacy and to create a reading culture by providing opportunities for residents to become more socially engaged in their community through a shared story. So, of course, this piqued my interest at this particular time and for this particular episode, because this seems to be a program or an example of something that's trying to read for social change, with all of the complexities and complications and probably troubles that practice comes with. So I'm really interested to see how this month goes and to check out the conversations that will happen around the book. And speaking of the book, Sisiquesis' book, Blanket Toss Under Midnight Sun, emerges from his social media project initially, Indigenous Archival Photo Project, which he started a few years ago. And his initial reason for the project, he says, was to seek and create a, quote, visual record of a positive framing of Indigenous peoples, end quote. And that comes from an APTN News story that I will put in the show notes. The book highlights some of these photos and stories that he collected from this, you know, initial social media project from across 8 Indigenous communities in North America. If you want to participate in One Book, One Province, I will put the link to the readings and the discussions that the Sask Library Association is putting on this month in the show notes. You can order the book from your favorite local bookstore. But also, through Paul Sisiquesis' website, which I will link to in the show notes, you can send a copy of the book to someone who is incarcerated. He has a sort of form and a method for doing that on his website. And you can also make a contribution on his site to support the Indigenous Archival Photo Project as he continues to work on it. Thank you to Diella Swain for the podcast music. You can find more of their work at soundcloud.com/DiellaS. That's DiellaS. Thank you to Jade McDougall at muskrat-hands.com for the awesome podcast graphics. You can follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at teachinbookspod, no G, or get in touch via email at teachinbookspod@gmail.com. You can use the hashtag #teachinbookspod if you want to talk about the podcast. Still not sure if that's necessary, but I continue to say it sometimes, not all the time.
And what else? I guess you can rate and review. I mean, that would be great if you can rate and review this podcast if you like it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're able to do so. All right, goodbye for now, but please join me again next week on Teachin' Books.